I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views. Last week was quite the time to be a political news junkie in the United States. And even that may prove to be an understatement. From the anti-climax of the impeachment trials to the chaos of the Democratic Party's Iowa caucus app apocalypse. And of course, Trump's State of the Union address, which ended with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi ripping up the president's speech. It was a busy week in Newsland. Joining us to unpack all of that and more is returning guest and all-around crackerjack journalist, J.P. Sitilli, otherwise known as the News Vandal. Now, before we jump in, one thing that struck me about this conversation was that J.P. took on a noticeably grimmer tone than in our previous discussions. And I suspect that his perspective on current hot-button issues ranging from the failure of impeachment to the Democratic Party split between progressives and the party's centrist establishment will have a little something for the left, right, and center alike to be disgruntled about. But hey, that's why we call this show Parallax Views. And with that being said, let's get right into the conversation with J.P. Sitilli, the News Vandal. Welcome back to Parallax Views. J.P. Sitilli, a.k.a. the News Vandal. I know right now you seem to be in a more melancholy mood with current events. How are you doing, though, J.P.?
I guess physically I'm above ground. I'm walking. I'm breathing. I'm able to eat and process food. I have to admit, I have many years of following politics and news and current events. I think my coming of age as a child was the Iran hostage crisis, and then you know, the Reagan presidency and then Iran-Contra was a very crucial part of my development, which would lead me to be, you know, get a degree in history and journalism. The Iraq War was definitely a low point. And then Abu Ghraib was another low point for me as an observer. Just it's hard sometimes to carry the burden of it when you see such a massive injustice taking place. But I have to admit that the impeachment process, the hearings, and then the trial, and I think when the trial began in earnest, the sense of melancholy that you alluded to really took hold. And because I could see that this was an incredible political gift to President Trump, and as we're speaking right now, I have – before we came on the air, I was watching, and I have it on in the background. I muted it because, you know, who cares? He's in the East Room right now continuing his victory lap / gloat session, which began this morning at the prayer breakfast. And with his approval rating going from 39% in the interregnum between Mueller's the delivery of Mueller's report and the beginning of the hearings on Ukraine – to 49% just a few months later, approval rating, his highest ever in that Gallup tracking poll, and consumer confidence or economic confidence being at like a 30-year high, it looks like his reelection is like the outcome of the Senate trial, a fait accompli.
Yeah, you have three new articles out on thenewsvandal.com. Starting with the article entitled The Impeachment Blunder, maybe we could talk just a little bit about that first, especially in regards to Nancy Pelosi and her role in the whole impeachment debacle.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was fascinating to watch, and these are debates that I had sometimes – out in the open in social media, certainly during some direct messaging with people who are Democrats. I, full disclosure, am not a Democrat. I've never been in the Democratic Party. I've never been a registered Democrat. And I think we've maybe visited this topic in the past. I actually think people who cover politics should abstain from voting because I don't think umpires should be betting on the games they're officiating. But I had this debate with Democrats about the wisdom of impeachment, particularly after Mueller's report was delivered. He did have the sort of the flop congressional hearing, but there were the 10 instances of obstruction of justice. And actually, if you look in the first part of the Mueller report, which did not determine or did not find any evidence linking Donald Trump to the Russian efforts, so therefore that came, you know, the no collusion description. There's actually, if you look in there, there's a lot of collusion all over the place. The name to look at is Kirill Dmitriev. Kirill Dmitriev, folks, look him up in the report. It's really interesting stuff in his connection to Kushner. But be that as may, Pelosi was resisting calls for impeachment at that time. And the story was that Pelosi was beating back the calls of activists in her own party and in her own caucus in the House calling for impeachment, and I saw a lot of dissatisfaction with Nancy Pelosi for being weak, not being willing to take on the president. And I assumed, because I don't know her actual internal thought process, I assumed that what she was looking at was the long-term politics of impeaching and decided that it was better to not do so politically as opposed – regardless of what the constitutional or legal arguments are. And so – I actually defended her as a matter of political strategy for doing so because it was my belief then, and it was something that was being reinforced as his poll numbers were dropping after the Mueller report, which went to the low of 38, that Donald Trump without an enemy is Donald Trump who can only turn on himself. And he was on Twitter and in press availabilities and press sprays, you know, his chopper talks and whatnot, he was saying a lot of wild and strange things because there was no target for his vitriol and deep need to identify himself as a victim. This persecution complex, which I think is the currency that connects him with voters. I think that is one of the main transactions between him and voters that unites them. And so I believed at the time that the best strategy when a man is beginning to immolate himself is to simply step away from the immolation and watch it burn. But then came the Ukraine stories, the first one I think it was in Politico, and Nancy Pelosi relented. I think the pressure inside the caucus was probably too great, and the pressure inside Democratic activist circles was too great, and she relented, and then came impeachment.
I guess I feel like it's a sort of rock in a hard place scenario, because I do feel like the Democrat Party is pushed back against their base and progressives to the point where progressives and that base can get really annoyed, and not without reason. Yes. At the same time, you know, where were things going to go with impeachment? Even though I was never really opposed to impeachment, I didn't know if it was going to pan out the way people wanted to.
I never thought it was going to pan out the way people wanted it to.
Do you think there were impeachable offenses?
I think yes. I think the problem with it, I think, is that the deed was never completed. I think had Zelensky actually gone through and announced a sham investigation on CNN, Fareed Zakaria's show, if it had gotten to that point, I think it probably would have been an even stronger case for saying it's impeachable. Completing the deed, I just think it psychologically completing the deed makes it more visceral as opposed to more theoretical, because in a sense this is there's a theoretical aspect to it not ever being carried out. You're entreating a foreign power or a foreign government to not only interfere, as they say, in the election, but you're also asking them to investigate an American citizen. I actually think that's almost more pernicious than interfering in the election. You're actually looking at it's like saying to Mohammed bin Salman, you know, we'd really like you to investigate Bob Smith over here because Bob Smith is a burr in my side. So since we know Bob Smith goes back and forth between Riyadh and Boston, when next time he comes to Riyadh, we'd like you to arrest him. That really flies in the face, particularly of many conservative viewpoints about the ultimate sovereignty of the American people and their exceptionalism in the face of things like the International Criminal Court. So, you know, that's an irony that you can play on. So, yeah, I mean, it is, but I don't know that it was as impeachable. It was impeachable enough to justify the political gamble that was being undertaken. You know, this is JG, you make a couple great points. I like to respond to the progressive thing too, because I think that is a great point. There is such a push and pull going back to the arrival of the DLC and Bill Clinton in the late 80s, which arose out of a response to the loss of Mondale to Reagan and then the loss of Dukakis to Herbert Walker Bush. Both of those losses really emboldened this new idea inside the Democratic Party, the Democratic Leadership Council, that you had to move to the center and be more business and Wall Street friendly and corporate friendly to stem what they believed was the bleeding of the Democratic Party in the face of what could have been the long-term impact of the Reagan Revolution. And ever since then, you know, I've made the case in the past that Bill Clinton, one of the things he did is he, in a sense, completed the Reaganomics Revolution. He, in many ways, finished Reagan's job. And that has created this schism inside the Democratic Party that persists to this day and is what you were talking about. So I do understand the incredible pressures that Nancy Pelosi was under when she finally relented. And I think, you know, my analysis of the impeachability of the offense notwithstanding, I do think that it was defensible constitutionally when you analyze the behavior, the abuse of power that Donald Trump engaged in, for her to make that case. My point is that one thing that Republicans have been willing to do that Democrats have putting the – except for Clinton, Bill Clinton and the Democratic Leadership Council have been unwilling to do is to let the ends justify the means and make compromises on principle to achieve victory.
And in regards to that number, 49% approval rating – maybe we could get into that and why you view that as so significant. I mean, beyond the fact that it's an all-time high for him, I think you would say it's significant for other reasons going into November.
I do. Because it's my assessment that Donald Trump, if his approval rating is north of 46%, he wins. You know, it's quite obvious based on the last election and really on previous elections that led up to this that the Democratic Party has to have an overwhelming turnout to overcome the Electoral College obstacle that favors the Republican Party. So Trump does not have to play for a majority of the votes. He does not have to play to win the popular vote. He does not have to do that to win. And as a matter of fact, what we saw in the last election, and this is if you want to say genius, we'll just say what was so clever about the Trump campaign is that it was not predicated on expanding his base and including more voters. It was on taking the rock solid foundation of his base as the upper ceiling of what he could achieve, and then using that as a barometer by which they measure victory. How? By driving down the turnout and favorability ratings of the opponent. So instead of trying to expand your base, what you do is you try and trim the turnout of your opponent, not nationally, but in key battleground states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North and South Carolina, Florida. So all you have to do is attack your opponent as opposed to try and expand your base to include more people. And
can I interrupt real quick?
Yeah.
I was going to say what's really interesting about the GOP is I think their constituency is actually shrinking.
Yes.
But they're able to maintain political power for a number of reasons, from gerrymandering to the Electoral College. And it's just created a weird situation where they can maintain political power without appealing to like a broad coalition.
Exactly. And add into that a copious amount of rat copulation. Right? And which is another thing that the Democrats don't do. The Democrats are not good at rat copulation. And the Republicans are excellent at it. Going all the way back to Nixon 68, Nixon 72, Reagan 1980. He didn't have to engage in rat copulation in 84, which is probably the only clean GOP presidential victory of the last 50 years. There was rat copulation when Dukakis was defeated between Willie Horton and one of the things that Lee Atwater set up in 1988 was that Dukakis was against the Pledge of Allegiance. So, you know, the things that they're able to run on are augmented by this willingness to engage in a kind of politics that the Democrats don't do well. Add to that these demographic shifts that have voters pooling into urban areas again. And so these urban areas in blue states, it coalesces huge amounts of Democratic voters into blocks that don't do anything to mitigate the Republican advantage in the Electoral College. It actually heightens it, in a sense, because the voters are not dispersed evenly in a number of states that would allow the Democrats to be able to pull an easy Electoral College victory if, for example, all of their voters were not pooled in New York and California. You know, I mean, Hillary Clinton's big win is in no small part in terms of popular vote is predicated on California. Well, that doesn't help. So the shifting of population, the demographic shifts that on paper in the aggregate look like, oh, this is doom for the Republican Party, in many ways are reinforcing the ability of a minority party to continue to hold a majority of power.
And in the impeachment blunder piece that you wrote, there's also an aspect of persecution complexes and how persecution scores big when it comes to Trump. That's an advantage to him, this idea that he's being persecuted.
Well, you know, he has to have an enemy. He thrives on an enemy. And he thrived on it in 2016. He thrived on it throughout the Mueller investigation. And I think what it does is it creates identification, a transom of identification between himself and voters. And particularly for example, the evangelical base that is such a crucial part of his hold on power. Evangelicals, having been an evangelical in the 70s, I grew up in the evangelical movement, so I feel like I can talk with some authority about it. Persecution complexes are key to the evangelical identity. And for the people who lived in the large swath of American carnage that Donald Trump identified in his inaugural address, these are people who, and I would say in some sense, quite rightly, have a well-developed persecution complex because they saw their livelihoods taken away from them. Now, what Donald Trump is able to do...
Do you mean economic stagnation?
Yes, economic status. He's able to take that feeling of disenfranchisement and persecution and direct it at targets who are not the actual causes, like the evil Chinese stealing jobs, when actually the people who stole the jobs were people who were on Wall Street and who are benefiting from Trump's presidency right now. You know, the misdirected anger and all of these things. I'm not saying anything revolutionary here, but I think there's another aspect to this, which the Democrats should have learned from their own experiences with Clinton's impeachment and just from popular culture and our trial and justice entertainment industrial complex, because we have that, right, where we obsess on criminal proceedings. You know, I remember when 2020 used to be a news magazine and Dateline used to be a news magazine as opposed to the criminal trial du jour. And one of the things that I've noted over the course of the decades is that the American people respond to those people who they believe are being unfairly persecuted or attacked by the judicial system. It's just a sympathy response. I think you saw it with O.J. Simpson, and you certainly saw it with Bill Clinton, that you get this sympathy response when it looks like people are being hounded or railroaded. And that became in Trump's case with impeachment, I believe it turned into a force multiplier effect for the persecution transaction that he already has with voters.
Well, there's also the fact, I believe the trial had really, really like low TV ratings.
Yes.
Most people weren't watching it.
Most people started out at 11 million on the first day, dropped to under 8 million the second day, dropped to under 7 million the next day, and then it started to flatline in the 4 to 5 million. So this is a nation of 331 million people. So what they were learning, and by the way, the number one source winner of all of the ratings numbers consistently throughout the impeachment trial was Fox News. So, and this is another one of those distortions where I think progressives were probably watching, if they were watching the impeachment trial through MSNBC and CNN, and all of the frame around the impeachment trial was one of look at this criminality, look at this overwhelming case, look at these terrible arguments by Alan Dershowitz, look at how awful Cipollini is and Jay Sekulow. When it, if you go over to Fox News, they were actually cutting out at 3 o'clock, going 3 o'clock Eastern time or five, maybe it's 5 o'clock Eastern time, going to the five and letting them sit around and just start hammering home all the talking points about how this is a witch hunt and how it's just how the Democrats hate him and they're persecuting him and there was no crime here. So, and whatever sound bites people may have been getting out of the trial, those sound bites, if they're getting them through traditional news sources, are necessarily going to show both sides of the argument. And so if you had a tendency to believe that the trial was frivolous, it was easily reinforced even by neutral coverage. Additionally, what I did is every time there was a break in the proceedings, I went to C-SPAN and I went to the call to listen to the callers, because I think if you want to know what's going on in the zeitgeist out there beyond whatever bubble you may be living in, go and listen to C-SPAN take calls. And what I heard relentlessly, now C-SPAN has Republican, Democrat, independent line, and I think they even put up sometimes a non-affiliated line, but independent is sort of the catch-all. And having worked at C-SPAN, I know that fairness is a religion there, and they go from one side to the next side to the next, and then repeat the cycle. They always oscillate between points of view. And I was hearing even flaccid support and sometimes criticism on the Democratic side of the trial, which said to me, this is really turning into a political loser.
I know some of my listeners are going to be yelling at,
sure,
at their screen right now. And I mean, I get it. I have to be honest. I do lean towards that progressive or left-leaning side, but I also see where you're coming from. I don't know where Democrats and where the left and the more progressive end of the Democratic Party goes from here, because I think we're going to be seeing the Trump victory lap for the next, well, right up to the actual election.
Exactly, right up to November. And this was when the impeachment drive started after the Ukraine story first broke. This was my caution, is that you are handing him a Teflon, an ability to celebrate a Teflon coating unlike anything we've seen in the past. There was a time when the Teflon president, the first Teflon president, was Ronald Reagan, who was able to brush off one scandal after another, much to the chagrin of journalists who broke open the scandals and obviously his Democratic opponents. Then there was a level of Teflon coating to Bill Clinton, but it didn't really kick in until the second administration, and which he kicked off with the State of the Union address when he said the era of big government is over. That goes back to he completed the Reagan Revolution. And, you know, George Bush did not really have that kind of Teflon coating. And he ended, I think when he left, his approval rating was 36 or 32. You know, his second administration was just a complete disaster. Obama did not have a Teflon coating either. I mean, there was a lot. He was buffeted by many, many scandals and disappointed many, many progressives. Having that kind of invincibility and Teflon coating to run on heading into November, I think is invaluable. It's an invaluable political gift. It's something that you just – it's rare and it's something powerful. And that victory lap, they keep coming at me because they hate me. And by hating me, that means they hate you. And being able to make that connection with voters – that's political gold. And I know people are might be upset, perhaps, or maybe disagree with me. That's fine. I'm just saying this as somebody who has observed politics in the American people for decades, and I live in an enclave. I'm in Northern California. I've lived in Washington, D.C. My family hails from Hackensack, New Jersey, so I'm familiar with the tri-state area. I know that in some of these enclaves, the sense is that, my gosh, Donald Trump is so outrageous, we can't really imagine how any of this even works on people. But it does. And it has. And this is stuff that has worked since Nixon. And if you look at Donald Trump's candidacy, I wrote a piece I can't remember if it was right before he was elected or right after he was elected, called Trump's Reagan Reboot. Donald Trump, you know, Make America Great Again was not his slogan. He did not come up with that. Ronald Reagan ran on that in 1980. Ronald Reagan. He has rebooted Ronald Reagan. It's really a mashup of Ronald Reagan and Nixon. He ran on tough on crime and you know, you gotta worry about all of these roving bands of not white people who are out there to take away the American dream from the silent majority. He mashed up Reagan and Nixon, Reagan 80 and Nixon 68, and his reelection is going to be a mashup of Nixon 72 and Reagan 84. And with the economic situation as hollow as I think the economy is, and as much of a Ponzi scheme as it is, most people don't know about the Fed's repo loan market. That's the overnight loan market, which is basically a new form of quantitative easing whereby the Fed is pumping billions of dollars into Wall Street on a nightly basis. So it's basically free money loans that they're able to use to speculate in the market, make their money that day in the market, and pay the loans back. And this is artificially inflating the market. But who in America knows about the repo loan market? If you sign up for the rundown, you know about it. If you go to Wall Street on Parade or WolfStreet.com, you know about it. But that's a very thin slice of people. So seeing the record highs in the stock market and the economic confidence that people have, consumer debt is reaching new highs, so people are spending on credit cards again. This is exactly the matrix of factors that Ronald Reagan rode to a 49-state drubbing of Walter Mondale, who at that time was painted as what? An out-of-touch, big government liberal. And liberal at that time had become an epithet, because that was one of the geniuses of the Republican brand during the Reagan years.
And that's before Fox News, too.
This is before right. Fox News. This is before Twitter. This is before social media. This is before Facebook found a massive revenue stream in taking Trump's super PAC under Brad Parscale and micro-targeting for big, you know, making big bucks off of their micro-targeting campaign to spread fallacious memes and stories all throughout the internet and all throughout Facebook. I mean, this is, you know, so I see this. It's like I'm watching this replay happen in slow motion. And as much as this may sound dire, I feel as an observer of this paradigm in the past, that is important to point out the historical corollary that I see happening.
Well, I think that sort of sums up another article I was going to bring up, the State of the Union, the Reagan yeah. reboot strikes again. Maybe we can come back to just some thoughts on the State of the Union and that awful Presidential Medal of Freedom incident with Rush Limbaugh. But I think I want to backtrack and get into the Iowa caucus, which you also wrote about
yeah.
in the piece, The Irony of Iowa's Caucus Crackup. I have to admit, the whole Iowa debacle, I'm amazed at the level of, at the very least, incompetence. I know other people will say conspiracy, but I'm not sure the facts of the case matter so much as the optics.
Right. Well, the facts of the case are going to matter to Bernie's supporters. I mean, that's for sure. The optics, though, and Trump and his East Room victory therapy session today pointed out, he said, these people want to run health care and they can't even count votes in Iowa. He said, our votes were counted that night. I won 98%. So there's that side of the pitch. The other side of the pitch is of the optics is that the Democratic Party is broken, and it appears to be broken. It appears to be broken to the casual observer, and it is obviously broken to people who are inside the Democratic Party trying to get results. And optically, I think for the going forward, I think one of the problems that the Democratic Party faces is that I don't think there's any secret that among the Democratic establishment, if there is such a thing, I guess Democratic establishment would be the people who have been there for a long time who are not on Bernie's team, that they have a great deal of trepidation about Bernie Sanders as a national candidate in the fall. And again, you know, I know you have progressive listeners and whatnot. I don't think that that's an unfounded trepidation, because I think that the socialism, socialism is going to become an epithet and is going to be weaponized over the course of the national campaign after the conventions in a way that is going to make 2016 look like child's play. So, but be that as it may, you know, for Bernie supporters, they actually have a point insofar as they feel like they got railroaded last time in Iowa, right? And they feel like they got railroaded over the course of the 2016 primary season. And so this looks like they're getting railroaded again. And one of the things that the Democratic Party has is a problem, because they can't win without Bernie's supporters, period. Because, as we established earlier, turnout has to be massive for Democrats to win a national campaign. They have to significantly outperform the Republican Party in turnout to win, significantly. Last time, 5 million people did not show up for the election. 5 million Democrats that the Democratic Party thought would show up and vote for Hillary Clinton and down-ballot Democratic candidates like Claire McCaskill in Missouri did not show up. These were missing voters. And Celinda Lake, who is a longtime Democratic pollster, who is one of those people who does the internal polls that you hear about but you never see. She went on I can't remember whose show she went on, the day after the election, when everybody was walking around shell-shocked, and was being asked, why did the polling fail? Well, the polling didn't fail. If you look at the Real Clear Politics average, Hillary Clinton won by basically the percentage point in terms of the aggregate number that they predicted she would. But the problem is that aggregate numbers are irrelevant when it comes to the Electoral College, because it's different. As we've noted earlier, so those 5 million people have to show up and then some this next election for the Democrats to win, particularly if they want any chance of taking Senate seats, down ballot Senate seats in some of these key states like Mitch McConnell in Kentucky and whatnot. So, Cory Gardner in Colorado, Martha McSally in Arizona. If you want to take some of these seats, you've got to have massive turnout. And that means you need Bernie Sanders supporters. You need Bernie Sanders enthusiasm. You need his get out the vote operation to be able to transition to a national campaign. And you need his ability to excite young voters, the elusive young voters who every year, every election cycle, Democrats say, but look at this enthusiasm among youth vote, and then the youth vote doesn't show up. The only two times it's really showed up, particularly the first time, was in 2008 for Obama, and in the second time. And why? Because that was when the Democrats had this huge advantage in technology, when they were using text messaging and all this stuff, and And it was the Obama coalition of young people and African Americans and suburban women, and it was and some blue collar workers in the middle in the Midwest, and it was this amazing thing. Of course, the irony being that this company, Shadow Inc., which is a subsidiary of Acronym, that now that itself all sounds incredibly shady, was also hired by the Democratic Party to help close the technology gap with the Republicans and Brad Parscale. And the incompetence shows that it's a loser on both of those counts, I would say. But you have to have Bernie's people. But by the same token, they think Bernie is a loser likely in the fall. So they're between a rock and another rock and a hard place, like Pelosi was in a rock and a hard place, as you noted, against impeachment. The Democrats have to have Bernie's people. They have to have them all on board. They have to have them enthusiastic. But Bernie's people are not going to be satisfied with anybody but Bernie, particularly now that it looks like the system is being rigged once again against him.
Well, the thing is, so I get where Bernie's supporters are coming from, being skeptical. And actually, just hearing over the past few days, I've heard from a lot of that establishment Democrat take that, why are there so many conspiracy theories? And my response to that, and I don't know if you would agree with this, JP, but my response to that has generally been those conspiracy theories don't happen in a vacuum, regardless of whether they're true. It's the job of the institution, in this case, the Democratic Party, to maintain the trust of its base. To me, there's an issue with the institution itself when you have a portion of the base so distrustful of that institution. I'm just curious what you think of that.
I absolutely agree. And you can see what happened to the Republican Party as a sort of a bellwether of that, or as a predictor of that, because the Tea Party in many ways was a revolt against the Republicans establishment inside the Republican Party. And look what happened over the course of Obama's 8 years. The Tea Party morphed into the most important and powerful force inside the Republican Party, and then they found their candidate that in Donald Trump, who was able to effectuate a complete overturning and evolution of the Republican Party into a different party. Now, in terms of policy, like actual on the ground policy, one could make the case that it really hasn't changed that much. It's still a combination of culture war and religious conservatives and corporate power and big oil and big defense and so on. But if you look at the shedding of what was considered the sort of the more moderate or acceptable or more widely acceptable Republicans inside the Republican Party as Donald Trump has taken over, I think you could see a future process like that happening inside the Democratic Party, because people inside the Republican, for the Tea Partiers, which immediately became, you know, on Obama's election, became an anti-Obama party. But originally, it was actually stoked by disillusionment over Bush's handling of the war and the beginning of the handling of the financial crisis. So that the Republicans, though, are much better. Guys like Mitch McConnell, the establishmentarians there, are much better at controlling, modulating, and absorbing their ideological core than the Democrats are. The Democrats suck at it, and they don't do what you pointed out. They don't inspire confidence. They don't go out and they don't use the power of the institution to create trust. There is a deep abiding distrust, which I would say is actually the bitter fruit of the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, from the 80s. This has been a long time coming, and I see the schism all the time. You can see it with Pete Buttigieg. He's another corporate Dem. He's another corporate Dem. I see that all over again. Or so he's called CIA Pete, right? He's a CIA agent. He's been sent here to infiltrate. And that sense of the ideological heart of the beating heart of the Democratic Party being infiltrated by the black soul of outside corporate influence or outside influence is a narrative that I think was birthed out of the Clinton transition of the Democratic Party away from its New Deal roots to its more corporate-friendly neoliberal version. And I think that that's a battle that is playing out right now in real time coming out of Iowa.
Well, it's interesting, too, because I've heard people try to downplay Iowa. Oh, this isn't a crisis. It's not a big deal. We can move on from it. I mean, I don't know. I think to the general public, it looks pretty bad regardless of how you look at it. There's people that are going to look at it and say they screwed Bernie. And then there's other people that are going to look at it and say, these people are so incompetent, why would I even vote for them?
Yeah. I mean,
either way you look at it, it does look like a crisis in my view, because it makes the Democratic Party look horrible either way, whether you're on team conspiracy or team incompetence.
At the same time, the Democratic Party's gambit to remove the president in advance of an election fails utterly.
Right. It's like a 1-2 punch.
Yes. Yes. You asked about my melancholy. So I'm not a Democrat. And I will not be voting in this election because I'm going to be writing and covering it and doing my rundown, my newsletter on it. And I want people to know that, to have some confidence that I'm not betting on a game that I'm trying to officiate. That being said, I do think that the only thing that really matters in this election cycle is the end of Donald Trump's presidency. Because as somebody who's looking at, I don't know, 2,000, maybe more articles a week as I compile the rundown and seeing what's happening in places like the Bureau of Land Management, what's happening in the Department of Agriculture and the USDA, what's happening with things like inspection line speeds at slaughterhouses, what's happening in every corner of the executive branch, there is a wholesale change happening. One that is incredibly destructive and pernicious if you care at all about something like air, land, water, pollution, carbon emissions. If you care at all about the judicial system, which is in the midst of an unprecedented takeover, particularly at the appellate court level, where the Trump administration, working in concert with Mitch McConnell, is installing people in the appellate courts who – overwhelmingly, the vast majority of them fail to get an ABA approval rating, you know, saying that these people are qualified. Most of them are listed as unqualified. If you look at some of the views of some of these people, many of them who are evangelicals who are being installed at the appellate courts being very, very important because you can have a decision against a corporation or somebody on a freedom of speech issue or something at a district court level, and then when it gets to the appellate courts, that's where it can be cut off. That's where it can just be hamstrung on its and overturned. That takeover is unprecedented. This is even more thoroughgoing than the Reagan court revolution. Also, if he's reelected, I just don't see how Ruth Bader Ginsburg lasts another 4 years. So there's a possibility of the court being 6-3 as opposed to, you know, you just look at every – or even it, – it's the stakes are incredibly high. And the amount of corruption that is going on, the number of agencies where lobbyists who used to fight – regulation of an agency for the industry that they were representing are now in charge of those agencies. That is almost 100%. I mean, it's throughout the administration. These are things that if another 4 years happens, if another 4 years of a Trump presidency happens, I think you're going to see a radically different form of executive power than we could have imagined, even during our deepest fears of the unitary executive of the time of John Yoo and Dick Cheney, because that's really why Bill Barr is there. Bill Barr is completing the unitary executive takeover.
The imperial presidency.
This is, yeah. It's been called the imperial presidency, but I think it's more accurately called the unitary executive, because the imperial presidency is also, you could say, is a byproduct of the Cold War, the continuation of the perpetual war state and the growth of the military-industrial complex after the demobilization dip of World War II, and then the mobilization rise under Truman, the beginning of the Iron Curtain speech by Churchill, and NSC 68 being signed by Truman, and that imperial presidency is one thing, but the unitary executive, this hyper-conservative federalist, what would become the Federalist Society, hyper-conservative ideological view that was really championed at first by Dick Cheney when he was in the Ford administration. Pardon me. and has been handed off by Dick Cheney in some way that was not apparent to me when Bill Barr first became Attorney General. Obviously, been handed off to Bill Barr. This is an idea that the executive has any power that is not enumerated in the Constitution is necessarily given to the executive. So it's not the executive has all the powers that are enumerated. It's that the executive also has any power that you can think of that's not mentioned in the Constitution. The executive gets that power. And if it's not specifically prohibited because the founders couldn't think of that happening at some point in the future, that power is necessarily given to the executive. And as a unitary executive, it stands above the judicial and legislative branches as the default for any challenge to their power. There is a default judgment that it should necessarily be given to the executive without without being able to make some kind of case that it is an existential risk that the executive has that power. So you have to make a radical argument that the executive's unitary ability to exert power is in some way an existential threat to the nation, right? And that's a high bar to set. And it's actually kind of a rhetorical trap that they're setting with the unitary executive, because essentially what they are saying is that the executive is in many ways a monarch. So this is another one of my criticisms of the impeachment process, is that knowing full well that the Senate would never in a million years convict Donald Trump, what they've essentially done is taken Trump's, whether you think it's debatable or not, they've taken his behavior, which was deemed impeachable, put it through the hopper in Congress, and what came out the other side was the imprimatur of the Congress saying, no, that is a behavior which is not impeachable and is actually acceptable because we have rubber stamped it. So, and ironically, they didn't put a constitutional check and balance on the president. They actually removed a check and balance and rubber stamped a behavior unintentionally.
For some reason, I'm thinking of the whole Dershowitz defense that everyone was mocking, where he said, well, he was doing it in the best interests of the nation.
Well, that's it. That's the unitary executive. You could say, if the president can say that what he's doing is in the national interest, if you cannot prove that what he is doing is an existential risk to the republic itself, it cannot be forbidden. You cannot forbid the executive from doing it, because And so on some level, when you said the imperial president, that is where it dovetails with the imperial president, where national security or national interest becomes a trump card that you can use to allow anything, right? And because of things like executive privilege and national security secrets and classification, you can basically say, well, you're just going to have to trust me on this, because if I was to tell you why I'm doing this, it would actually endanger the national security that I am trying to secure by engaging in a behavior that you think is unconstitutional.
Do you think, with regards to impeachment...
JG, I mean, I'm sorry to be so depressing here, you know? I'm not trying to – this is not a Jeremiah, but maybe it is. Maybe it is, because I think that this is actually a this is a crossroads, and we are entering an election in which the very nature of American politics and the ability to exact recourse politically through the constitutional system is about to be kneecapped.
Well, I think it's just been bad just leading up to all of it. I mean, I know you said impeachment was bad for the long game, but at the same time, if there was no talk of impeachment, if they hadn't gone through with anything, wouldn't that also set like a precedent of allowing all of this with Trump?
Well, no, because if I had been consulted, I would have said, why don't you replay the Benghazi scandal and basically hold hearing after hearing after hearing all throughout the summer, continue to establish all of the level of corruption. I foresaw the Lev Parnas thing. I knew that Lev Parnas was going to be a big deal, and we have actually, you know, the Lev Parnas part of all of this still has not even been taken up by Congress, which is that ironically, when all we hear about is Burisma, is that Lev Parnas and Rick Perry were using the Ukraine scandal, this Ukraine thing, shakedown, to install cronies onto the board of Naftogaz, the state natural gas company. So the very thing that the Republicans were pointing fingers at Hunter Biden for is exactly what Trump and Pompeo and Rick Perry and Lev Parnas were doing with Naftogaz. So I, playing the long game, would have suggested, why don't you just continue to hold hearings exposing criminality and have this drip, drip, drip over the course of the entire summer to do what? To do exactly what Kevin McCarthy said that they were doing to Hillary Clinton when he went on cable news and was asked about the latest failed Benghazi hearing, right, which was the 12-hour – I think he said this right after the 12-hour interrogation that Hillary Clinton sat through in the middle of the campaign. And he said, look at where her – approval ratings were before we did it, and look at what our approval ratings are after we did it leading into the election. I think it was a big success. And that's what the Republicans are willing to do, which is to say, maybe there is a constitutional principle here that we should impeach this guy to make a judicial and constitutional point and a legislative point about the separation of powers. Or maybe what we should do is use this as a political tool to expose his corruption over the course of 3 to 5 months leading into the election and not give him the vindication and acquittal at the end that we know is going to come. And then what you have is an election in which all of that kind of corruption is part of the stew or the equation that voters are considering going in. And then if he is thrown out of office, then you've had your check and balance kicked in, which is an electoral remedy for a corrupt president.
I had not thought of that. I need some lessons in a political strategy, maybe.
Well, this is – I've I feel like the Democratic Party has learned the wrong lessons over and over again. I'll take you back to the DLC and Clinton. The Mondale wipeout was just going to come because I lived through the end of the 70s and the early 80s, particularly the first 2 years of the Reagan administration, when they were engaging in severe austerity, the economy was in the crapper, and when they basically put the sugar high into the economy with the tax cut, the economy exploded. Also, add to that military Keynesianism. A big part of the Reagan economic miracle was actually socialism, military Keynesianism, which is pumping huge amounts of money into the defense industry. One of the things that we forget about when money goes into the defense industry is it doesn't just go into the pockets of corporate leaders of defense companies. It provides high paying, often union jobs for people building military hardware. And that creates economic boomlets wherever that military hardware is being built. And the way the military-industrial complex has been structured is to pepper all of those military contracts around congressional districts and states with senators, so that it creates a constituency for continuing to fund the military, because that's jobs, and good-paying jobs equals electoral victory for members of Congress and for senators. And also, I think, is, you know, one of the things that we overlook is that the American people themselves are complicit in the military-industrial complex, because a lot of people make their money off of the military budget. But when I look at things like the Dukakis loss or the Jimmy Carter loss, for example, people have learned the wrong lessons. Jimmy Carter lost in no small part because Bill Casey and Herbert Walker Bush and Dick Allen and others scuttled Jimmy Carter's negotiated release of the hostages from Iran. And if you look at the 6 weeks leading up to the election in 1980, Jimmy Carter was closing the gap on Reagan. Why? Because people said, you know, we liked what this Reagan was saying, but now we're looking at him and he's a TV star. He's a B-movie actor and he's kind of nutty, and he was kind of almost a John Bircher, and we don't know if we want him near the button. Boy, have we heard that before? So that was 1980. And so Carter was closing the gap, and he had negotiated a release of the hostages, and suddenly the Iranians pulled out of the deal. Well, we've learned since that one of the reasons they pulled out of the deal is because they got a better deal from the incoming incoming Reagan administration, who said, if you hold their release, and they were released exactly as Reagan was taking the oath, they were released in exchange for what? For military hardware and spare parts they needed for their war against Iraq, because they had a military that had been purchased almost entirely from the United States supermarket of military hardware. And they had been embargoed by Carter after the hostage situation. They needed weapons, and that opened up what would become the pipeline called Iran-Contra. So that was a rat copulation won election. Dukakis lost. He was at 17 points coming out of the Democratic convention. If you read interviews with him, one of the things that motivated him was what? Was the Iran-Contra scandal. Who was implicated in the Iran-Contra scandal? Herbert Walker Bush, who desperately needed to make sure that the Democrats could not get control of the instruments of the Justice Department to prosecute people criminally for what happened in Iran-Contra. That would be George Herbert Walker Bush and many of the people around him. What did they do? They engaged Lee Atwater in a rat copulation campaign that used the Willie Horton ad and questioned Dukakis's patriotism, said he was against the Pledge of Allegiance, and it was the first significant mobilization of what would become the Christian Coalition, which was born out of Pat Robertson's run for the presidency in Iowa against Herbert Walker Bush in the primaries, to basically rat copulate a win against Dukakis. Now, it didn't help that Susan Estridge put Dukakis in a tank with a helmet on, and he looked like a bobblehead, which is one of those political blunders, great political blunders of my lifetime. But that was a rat-copulated election. And why was it rat-copulated? Because they could not afford to allow the Democrats to take control of the instruments of the Justice Department, much in the same way there is no way that that Trump and the people around him, particularly senators like Rob Portman and Rick Scott, who have ties to Lev Parnas, could ever in a million years allow anybody but Bill Barr to be in charge of the Justice Department, where he is running interference to hide all of the corruption that is going on around Donald Trump. So all I'm saying is I've watched this. There was rat copulation against Ross Perot in that election, when Ross Perot was actually starting to run neck and neck with Clinton and Herbert Walker Bush. People don't know this, but Ross Perot and Herbert Walker Bush hated each other with the passion of a thousand burning suns, in no small part because Perot was made POW czar by Reagan, and he went to Southeast Asia looking for POWs. He had been somebody who had funded his own private investigators and mercenaries to go throughout Southeast Asia
Didn't Colonel Bo Gritz tie into that whole thing?
Yes, Bo Gritz tied into that whole thing. So he goes looking for POWs, and he gave a famous, although never seen, interview with 60 Minutes, because he was forced out of his position, left forced out of his position. And the story is that he said he confronted Herbert Walker Bush and said, "George, I go to Southeast Asia looking for our boys, and all I do is find intelligence services dealing drugs." So it turned into a point of great contention between the two of them. The 60 Minutes interview was spiked. Monica Jensen Stevenson wrote about it in a book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye. And he despised Herbert Walker Bush. Well, there was some rat copulation there. I don't know if hopefully all of your listeners are too young to remember. I do remember. He suddenly dropped out of the campaign because he said people were threatening his daughter and threatening to disrupt his daughter's wedding. And he dropped out, and then he came back in later. Now, his participation in the race probably helped deliver the presidency to Clinton. But as we know, the choice between Clinton and Herbert Walker Bush was not nearly as stark of a choice as it would have been between Ross Perot and either of the other two, right? So I've just watched, and then there, of course, is the 2000 election, which was basically rat copulated in advance, with massive numbers of Florida Democrats being purged by a company that was associated with Rudolph Giuliani.
And then there was the whole thing with Roger Stone trying to start riots in Florida.
Yes. So what I've noticed over the course of my lifetime as an assiduous follower of politics, probably to my own personal detriment, I should probably be doing things like Etruscan poetry, but I do politics, is that there are two sides playing, and one side is playing with a knife and the other side is playing with a flower. And it's getting to the point at which the ultimate takeover of the unitary executive is nigh. It's coming. And so my sense of these things informed my analysis of the problems with impeachment. And I don't understand why they can't look at how successful the Republicans have been, particularly since Obama's been elected. You don't have to go back as far as I do. You don't have to do the history stuff. How about just ever since the day Obama was elected? And what did Mitch McConnell say? It is my mission to make sure that he is a one-term unsuccessful president. And there is Obama saying what? Well, I'm going to say I want to reach out across the aisle. And he just got smacked. And here's the upshot of it. Him trying to be moderate to please a vast number of people, doing things like genuflecting to Wall Street in the face of this massive collapse of the financial system, did two things. It did nothing to ingratiate him with the center, or with the center right, or with Republicans. And what it did conversely is alienated him from progressives that Democrats need desperately to have any chance of winning any election. So there is, so if there's a theme to this today's discussion, JG, you came up with it. It's called The Rock and the Hard Place and being lodged in between them two.
Really quickly, because I know we've gone a little bit over, thoughts on not necessarily just the State of the Union, but maybe the two incidents everyone is talking about with regards to the State of the Union. First, the Nancy Pelosi ripping up his speech incident is all over the news. And then this Rush Limbaugh Medal of Honor, it makes me want to vomit.
Yeah. I'm kind of mixed on the Nancy Pelosi thing. On one level, I think it's the Democrats have to be careful not to take the bait when they're being trolled. And it's actually the same point I would make about the Rush Limbaugh thing. I mean, that is the ultimate troll of trolls. I mean, that is troll level 11 on the part of Donald Trump. Just took that button that everybody has and just pushed it repeatedly with the Limbaugh thing. Also, it's a brilliant transaction because Limbaugh does marshal millions of voters, and he ensured that all he's going to get is effusiveness for his victory lap leading into November. Not that Limbaugh wasn't already doing that, but it works on a number of levels. And this is one of the things that Trump does, is he engages in transactions with people who will become indebted to him and will deliver to him. And that's one example, because in a sense, all of Limbaugh's listeners are now indebted to him, because by proxy, they feel like they've gotten the Medal of Honor too, because they are in the club with Limbaugh. And so they are part of it's been bestowed upon them as well. As to Nancy Pelosi, you know, she's had a couple of very strong moments. The famous picture where she stood up and pointed her finger at Donald Trump when she said it was in the middle of the Ukraine investigation before the impeachment trial, and said, "With you, all roads lead to Putin." But the picture was her standing up and being very sort of being strong in terms of her condemnation of him and looking very strong. The same thing was the famous clap from the previous State of the Union. This one, I think, is maybe a little bit different because it didn't look like a strong response. It looked like it was done, I think, out of weakness, out of a sense of helplessness. All that's left to do is to just rip it up and walk away. Now, she had her, I think it's a decent explanation, which is that it was a manifesto of lies or mendacity or whatever she said, but by the same token, I think it kind of punctuated became part of a troika of Democratic impotence. You take impeachment acquittal, you take Iowa debacle, and then there he is running amok at the State of the Union, and all you can do in response is something fairly petty, which is to rip up a speech. It just symbolizes the flaccidity with which the Democrats are facing the challenge going into November.
I think that's fair enough. I just want to comment real quickly on the Rush Limbaugh thing. I'm just like amazed that I get that he has, I guess, he's in the advanced stages of cancer. But the fact that he's getting a Medal of Honor is just beyond me. And I think people should reevaluate his legacy at this point, because I think the amount of damage he's done has been forgotten over the years.
Well, CBS News had a list of his most controversial 20 of his most controversial things that they ran near the top of their website today. That's CBS News. Okay, so he does have a number of racist and misogynist things that he has said, and you go back to the beginning of the Ditto Heads, right, in the 90s, when he was railing against feminazis, for example, as I recall. He in his own way, was a pioneer of the right-wing media matrix that we find supporting Donald Trump today. But I'll tell you, in doing the rundown, one of the things I do, and people, if you get the rundown, you will see this. You will see that I go to a number of sources that you probably, if you are a progressive or a moderate, you'll never go to. And the corollary that I saw being made, the comparative I saw being made, is that how is this any different than Obama giving the Medal of Freedom to Ellen? And so for people who feel persecuted, feel that they are talked down to, feel that the so-called liberal or elites or whatever the heck they are, views them as less than, it is the ultimate troll. I mean, I was going to say penultimate troll because the ultimate troll is reelecting Donald Trump, but it's a statement of defiance that I think registers with his supporters. And I think this is something that has got to be kept in mind, is that you cannot use your own personal set of standards as the barometer by which you judge what is acceptable broadly in the American culture right now.
Right. Yeah, because my first reaction when you said that was that I didn't know that they were bringing up the Obama-Ellen
thing. Oh, yes.
But my first reaction when you said that was, well, Ellen wasn't getting people in the Democrat Party to switch Republican to sabotage the Republicans, which is what Limbaugh did. That was a strategy that he pioneered. As you pointed out in your article, he basically told Republicans to switch over to being Democrat and then vote for a candidate they thought that Republicans could beat.
They're doing that again right now, actually, in South Carolina and other places. They're organizing Republicans to vote for Bernie. That's happening right now.
I guess that's what I wanted to end on, the whole Bernie moment, because and I have to admit, I'm probably biased towards Bernie in my own ways, and I think a lot of people supporting Bernie feel very desperate right now, or they feel like they're in a sort of clinch moment. What would you say to them maybe at this time in regards to your analysis, but maybe advice or where they should go from here?
I really don't know, because I have to say the one thing, there is a certain appeal to having Bernie Sanders on the stage with Trump, because the way I measure everything is who can stand on a stage with Trump and give as good as they get. And I think Trump, you know, the Protestant wannabe mafia don from Queens, would find rhetorically his match in Bernie from Brooklyn. So there is this, I understand that.
I have to say, I was impressed with Bernie's response to the "no one likes you" Hillary quip.
Yeah.
He just said, on a good day, my wife likes me.
No, I mean, that's classic. I mean, it's right out of the Catskills. It's beautiful, right? So he has that capability. And I think that any paranoia on the part of Bernie's hardcore supporters that the Democratic establishment is suspicious of his ability to win is well-founded. And I will admit that I share their suspicion, because I think that he has not yet endured what is going to come, which is going to be a negative campaign unlike anything that has been seen since the Dukakis campaign. And I'm not sure that Medicare for All and socialism is going to play in those key battleground states outside of the deeply blue parts of the country. So that being said, the other thing that I noted is Bernie has had 4 years to establish his brand. He has near 100% name recognition. And in spite of all of that, and in spite of the unparalleled enthusiasm of his supporters, still 3 out of 4 people in Iowa chose somebody else. 3 out of 4. And I know people say, well, yeah, there are more choices. Yeah, but if Bernie was really strong, Elizabeth Warren would not be getting the traction she was getting. And he would have pulled more people from from Biden and Buttigieg. He would have gotten not one out of four. He would have gotten 2 out of 4, right? So I think that that's, to me, that's a little cautionary. Now, we'll get, I think, a much – we don't – Iowa being what it is, I think the much better tests are going to be New Hampshire and South Carolina, and particularly South Carolina, because to me, South Carolina is much more representative of what the electorate is going to look like, particularly the Democratic electorate is going to look like in the long term, because that's going to be the first time you're going to have a significant portion of African-American voters chiming in on who they want to have president. And there's another group that you cannot win a Democratic election without, and that's black voters. You have to have black Americans. You have to. You can't – it's not possible to win without 90 to 92% turnout by them. So advice – the only thing I would say is this, is that there is only one thing that matters in November, and that's defeating Donald Trump. So should Bernie somehow not end up as the nominee, you're just going to have to hold your nose and vote for somebody who does not match your ideological test. Because another 4 years of Donald Trump is going to make all of your hopes and dreams completely moot.
Do you think any of the other candidates can beat Trump?
No, that's the problem. See, this is the catch 22 I think we find ourselves in. I think on paper I can maybe come up with a formula whereby Buttigieg, as yet another young, polished, educated, partially charismatic, because I think he does have sort of an empathy gap. He's somewhat robotic, but
a lot of Bernie supporters have been memeing comparisons between Pete Buttigieg and American Psycho. Maybe it's the robotic element. That's why.
Well, and also because he was at McKinsey, right? You know, he has that corporate background. So, I think the issue of him being gay is not as big as people think, because I think that there's a bit of a – I think the change in that – and you also have Jared Polis, who is now governor of Colorado. And, you know, so I think that's not as big of a hurdle, but I think the bigger hurdle is how he would reinvigorate – that schism inside the Democratic Party between progressives who feel like they have been continually slighted by the Democratic establishment, and the Democratic establishment foisting upon them a candidate who does not match their hopes, dreams, and aspirations. So I think that's a big challenge. I think on a stage, Buttigieg would compare well with Donald Trump on two things, on military service and on Christianity. But still, even there, I'm not convinced. I'll be honest with you. I'm not convinced anybody in the Biden is wounded, because, you know, the upshot of Ukrainegate and the acquittal is that it actually worked. All the American people heard about for 3 months was Hunter Biden and Burisma. That is a mission accomplished. That is actually what Donald Trump sought from Zelensky. He actually achieved as a bank shot bonus of his acquittal. So I think
Biden has also created some of his own problems lately too.
Well, yeah,
the way he responds to criticism is not exactly. I mean, he said on multiple occasions, basically, "Well, don't vote Democrat. Why are you talking to me?" Like he seems very short fused at this point.
Yeah, and I think that that's also an outgrowth of the impeachment debacle.
Yeah.
Right. It worked. It took him off his game, made him look weak and wounded, made him look like another Hillary Clinton on some level. It's his version of the Clinton Foundation. So Biden, I think, is a non-starter to win the general. I think the one thing he had going for him is that he was the "I'm just getting the car out of the ditch" candidate. Right. You're just electing me. I think his peak moment was when he had his campaign float the trial balloon that they said he floated with them, that he would be a one-term only president, that he would commit to only being there for 4 years, just because he's there to basically be the reset button on the American computer, right? That, I think, was a slightly interesting and potentially strategically smart thing to do, but I think that's long gone. I think Biden's got no shot. There's no way that I think Warren is mortally wounded by the process. I think she needed to win big in Iowa, and I think the problem is that there's the split with Bernie's people. Maybe she can do something, but I don't see it there. Klobuchar, no. Oddly enough, the person who is benefiting from all the chaos is who? Mike Bloomberg.
Oh my God, that would be terrifying.
And see, and what you just said shows the conundrum that the Democrats face. Because if it's Mike Bloomberg, a billionaire who made his money selling information to Wall Street, I mean, it's you know, JG, I am staggered by the complete lack of talent at the national level in the Democratic Party. I really am. And I think, you know, if Bernie was not the thing that makes Bernie appealing is also maybe his Achilles heel. Bernie is as authentic as you can get. There is nothing inauthentic about Bernie. He is true to himself. That's why Joe Rogan endorsed him. Again, there's another example of the schism. Look at all of the people inside the Bernie's tent who were appalled at Joe Rogan's approval of him, his endorsement of him. That is stupidity. You want to widen the tent as big as possible, and Joe Rogan brings people into your tent because you want to win. And so that's the conundrum for Bernie and his supporters, is that their commitment to authentic ideological purity does not expand the tent. And because the Democrats need overwhelming majority, an overwhelming turnout, and a huge majority to win, you need to expand the tent. There's another catch-22.
Well, hey, JP, I kept you overtime. I gotta give you a moment here to promote the News Vandal, and maybe to sort of wrap this up and put a bow on everything, I just want to maybe, if you could, what do you think another 4 years of Trump would mean in brief?
Well, I think it would be,
I guess what I'm looking at is beyond the unitary executive. Like, what would that mean, that unitary executive?
Well, the unitary executive is basically going to mean that Congress is really in a rubber stamp role. The courts will end up becoming a rubber stamp for everything that the executive does because of the radical transformation that will be completed in another 4 years of appointments to the appellate court and then the Supreme Court. I think you're going to see severe restriction on abortion beyond the restrictions that are already in place. I mean, it's going to be – you're going to see first trimester abortions and that's it. And it may even be – only, you know, eight to 10 weeks into the first trimester. I mean, you're going to see, you'll see that. You are going to see you're going to see the factory farming, big ag businesses flourish and grow. You're going to see oil flourish and grow in terms of its access to federal lands. I think you're going to see the Democratic Party restricted even more because they will have more ability to put voting restrictions and on electoral systems around the country. I just think you're going to see a multi-generational effect of another 4 years because there are many things happening, like for instance records that are being shredded in contravention of federal law. Records, this is a story that was just out in the Times this week. Records are being shredded all around the Trump industry. They are hiding the paper trail of the cronyism, corruption, and changes to government policy at every level. And so the ability to exhume what happened over the last 4 years and correct it will be wiped away. So that, to me, is even more daunting than things like changes to the court system, because what that means is that these things will become precedents that will be established for a generation or two. So anything that you see happening now, just project out that it will be almost impossible to extricate the splinters that are being put into the body politic, and they will be driven down deeper into the skin than ever before. Put a bow on this, JG.
I wanted to say real quick, not to interrupt you again, but I didn't even think of what that would mean for voting restrictions. I'm reading that new Tom Hartman book, The Hidden History of the War on Voting, and it's a really devastating look at voter suppression and whatnot. I can only imagine if that unitary executive came into play, how much more of that we would see. Just because, stealing the vote, essentially.
Right, and because the Justice Department will be at the disposal of Trump's version of the Republican Party, forget about it. You're never going to have any recourse. I mean, I think that's the takeaway, is that what you are seeing is the foreclosure of the political system as an avenue of recourse for voters. And that's a fundamental change. You know, as bad as the American system has been in the past and all of the crimes and things that we've talked about, the one wild card that has always been there is that if voters were to ever get organized and vote, they do have the ability to affect change. And through turnout, you do have the ability to affect change. It happened in 2018 with that sort of record turnover of the House, right? But I think what you are going to see is the increasing inability of citizens to access recourse through the governmental system, not just through the political system and voting, but also through the courts, because the courts are being shut down as an avenue of recourse. And another 4 years of Trump means that those avenues that are being shut down now are going to be bulldozed for generations to come.
Well, I know you said you're not trying to be depressing, but
yeah. So, and if you would like to be depressed on a daily basis, every 5 days a week, I put out a thing called the News Vandal Rundown. What I do is I get up every morning and I collect hundreds of stories, literally, and then I edit them down so that I have different categories, and then I edit them down so that the headlines themselves tell the story of the news cycle. So you'll get an email in your inbox, and you'll see this massive list of stories. Don't be daunted by it. Really, what you're supposed to do is, over the course of about 8 to 10 minutes, is just read the headlines. And if you read the headlines, you will probably be better informed about the news cycle than almost any of the news readers you see on cable news. And then if you see stories you like, you can click on them and see them. And you will also note that I use stories from a variety of sources. I use conservative and liberal. I use progressive and evangelical. I use different stories from different points of view and often put them next to one another. And sometimes you'll see stories seemingly canceling out the stories that came before them. That is intentional, because I'm trying to give you a full picture of what is out there in the news cycle. You can get to that by going to newsvandal.com. It's spelled like it sounds, newsvandal.com. And a box is going to pop up. You just type in there your email address, and we'll come to your inbox. I also do recommend, particularly if you're on Gmail, putting newsvandal.com on your safe list, because Gmail has a tendency to mark my emails as dangerous content.
Wow. Whew. I did not know that they were doing that.
Yeah.
Well, hey, JP, I want to thank you again for coming back on Parallax News. It's always a fascinating conversation with you, and I hope people check out the News Vandal Rundown.
Thank you for letting me hold forth at length. I appreciate your indulgence.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. As I said in the lead up to the conversation, I suspect that some of JP's takes will be controversial with my listeners. I'm not sure that even I agree with everything JP said. Maybe that's because of my own biases, I don't know. But he's agreed to come on again in the next few weeks to discuss things further. In any case, I highly recommend checking out his work at newsvandal.com, where you can subscribe to The Rundown, JP's daily compilation of news stories from a variety of different sources. Let me tell you, it is an invaluable resource. Let me know your thoughts about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon, where you can hear the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was, as well as archived editions of previous Parallax Views content. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.